bishops resign. He's accepted the resignations, I think, of five or six. And so that process is going on right now. He's trying to clean that up.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Thomas Doyle and Peter Eisele. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Effect on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon White Stag Block in Portland. Effect is a two-day conference that examines the work, culture, and design of social change. This grassroots event featuring stories from multiple marginalized activists, creators, and technologists working towards social change. Again, that's Affect on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon, White Stag Block, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. American Indian Day is a traditional showcase and celebration of American Indian and Alaskan Native cultures and community, which raises awareness concerning the challenges that Native American people face in this country. This event features vendors, educational booths, food, entertainment, and more. Again, that's Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 700 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland. Presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics. Sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury in the Time of Trump, Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at OregonSymphony.org.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Linda Olson Osterlund, and I'm your host this morning for More Talk Radio. I'm a guest host. Our regular hosts, Cecil and Celeste, have a few weeks off right now, and I am really happy to be the guest host. And we have a good show for you today. It's Peace, Sovereignty, Reconciliation, Peace, Sovereignty, Reconciliation, and Reunification of Korea. And we have a great guest as well. Her name is Christine Hong. She is an assistant professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who focuses on transnational Asian American issues, the Korean diaspora, and critical Pacific Rim issues. She She is also a board member of the Critical Ethnic Studies Association and an executive board member of the Korea Policy Institute, a coordinating committee member of the National Campaign to End the Korean War, and a member of the Working Group on Peace and Demilitarization in Asia and the Pacific. And you know, she's made her focus be on these issues, and particularly on peace and reunification in between North and South Korea. And we're very much to have her here. I don't know if many of you have noticed, I didn't quite catch it on the news this weekend, but there's been another sort of blow up in the negotiations and the relationship between the United States and Korea. We will be talking about that today, and we'll be talking about more and the history of it. Welcome to KBOO, Christine Hong.
Thank you, Linda.
I'm so glad we have you on today. I didn't plan to have the news headlines be all about North Korea and the United States this morning, but it certainly looked like there were a lot of them when I was checking the news this morning. It appears that the latest news is that the United States has, Trump has declared that he's not going to go forward with the next meeting at this time. It was coming up very quickly. Also, North Korea's national newspaper has come out with accusations against the United States, basically saying that it's talking smiles towards reunification and peace, but doesn't really mean it. So can we start with the most recent, and then we'll backtrack, because I want to talk a lot about the about how the people of North and South Korea express their desires to be reunified. But can we take on what's just most recently happened first, Christine?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's if you listen to the Trump administration, first of all, it's sends out a series of incoherent messages with regard to North Korea. And so, you know, on the one hand, you have, Trump now has stepped back from pushing for maximum engagement with North Korea, which he stated was a signature feature of his policy. And that's very much in line with people like John Bolton. You know, John Bolton he recently stated that North Korea has not kept any of its promises and that it's failed to denuclearize. And, you know, Trump has sort of taken to that line of thinking by stating that North Korea has not made sufficient strides in denuclearization. Now, let's look at the actual picture. So what happened was when, you know, North Korea and the United States, you know, when the respective leaders, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, met in Singapore, what was stated very clearly on North Korea's end from the very beginning was that the United States had to take commensurate steps. So North Korea has always stated that its approach is a step-by-step approach. In other words, North Korea takes one step, the United States takes one step. Let's look realistically at what North Korea has done. Not only has North Korea suspended any weapons testing for over 200 days, you know, I mean, there's been even the U.S. commanding officer in South Korea stated that there's been no, quote unquote, provocations from North Korea. So not only has North Korea done that, but it's also taken steps to dismantle its nuclear testing sites. Those are major, major concessions. What else has North Korea done? North Korea actually released three Korean Americans who were held prisoner for having committed state crimes while in North Korea. They released those three prisoners. The other thing that North Korea did was that it repatriated the remains of 55 what are believed to be American service personnel. What has the United States done? It has simply suspended one war exercise. And this war exercise with its South Korean ally, it's not nothing. North Korea has called for the suspension of these war exercises since the beginning of their existence. But particularly in the Barack Obama period, North Korea stated that if the United States suspended those war exercises, that it would suspend its nuclear testing. Now, what do those war exercises do. They simulate the invasion and occupation of North Korea, the decapitation of its leadership, and they also simulate a nuclear first strike against North Korea. And the United States has long maintained that these are business as usual. Only when Donald Trump came into office and after having met with Kim Jong-un at Singapore, did he actually describe these war exercises as provocative and unhelpful. And, but, you know, I mean, so that's not a small thing, but what's still in place? Trump's maximum pressure policy. Well, what is his maximum pressure policy? What is it? It's actually the most severe package of sanctions that are aimed at crushing North Korea's viability. I mean, this actually targets things like fuel. When you target things like fuel, you're targeting things like agriculture. When you're targeting things like agriculture, you're targeting the people's capacity to exist. And so, you know, let's be really clear about the U.S. sanctions policy. It's not a soft policy. It's aimed at the regime collapse of North Korea, and it's always been an explicit part of U.S. war policy. The other thing, too, is that the United States maintains, you know, through its nuclear triad, an offensive posture within the region. So most recently, what North Korea has stated through its international organ, the KCNA, is that the United States has been conducting a series of drills that it hasn't announced to the world that are highly provocative with U.S. special forces that are aimed at the invasion of North Korea. And so North Korea has just basically stated, you can't have it both ways. You can't talk peace out of one side of your mouth and then declare war on the other.
And that's one of the most recent statements coming out of North Korea via the main newspaper there. I do want to let our audience know this is a call-in program. I want to hear from you about your questions and your concerns and your comments about this issue. And the number is 503-231-8187. Once again, that's 503-231-8187. I'll open the phones in just about another 5 minutes. Well, Christine, you did a really good job of quickly summing that up. I noticed that the article in the newspaper from North Korea did mention those drills, and then the U.S. responded saying, "Drills? What drills? We don't know what you're talking about." And that's obviously frustrating. So it appears that. And I also saw one article that said, and I don't know if it happened at the same, right in the same time, but in this last period, that there appears to be less activity in dismantling the missile testing, engine testing sites that they were working on. And so, and that's been the international organization that covers nuclear arms has stated that it appears that that has slowed down or become a stop. And so, in some ways, it feels like we're back to, you know, being pushed far apart. But what I've been, you know, I this also happened just before the June summit, we know. And just before the Olympics, the U.S. did a really hardcore push to try to, you know, cut against the fact that both Koreas were going to be marching under a united flag. And
right.
I wanted to talk a little bit about that because what I noticed in the U.S. press immediately following the summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un was that the press went crazy, including that other, that major public news network, went crazy trying to say how awful this was, that there would actually be a possibility of denuclearization, that the U.S. would actually stop doing its war exercises. That was one of the things they focused on. And there was a lot of misleading and, I think, you know, just rewriting of history going on during that time. I was listening all day to the radio and checking on the news, and it seemed to be that they were conflating Kim Jong-un and his father. They were, like, saying how bad Kim Jong-un was and saying that he broke agreements with us back in the 90s. Well, he wasn't the leader in the 90s, and he didn't break any agreements back then, but nobody countered that argument all day when I was listening on the news. And so it feels to me like, and at the Olympics, what I wanted to say is it seems like the people of North Korea, I mean, North Korea and South Korea very much want reunification. And they showed it in huge demonstrations on the Olympics, you know, where they would come marching, they marched out together.
Opening ceremony.
Yeah, they had cheerleaders. And every time the U.S. Announcers tried a little bit to mock that attempt at reunification, it was so overrun by the clear joy of the Korean people at having this opportunity to march together and be together. And as a matter of fact, just in the last few days, there was once again a meeting, I think they've held these before, where people who thought we were lost from the South Korea to North Korea, who had not been able to talk to their relatives since the not real ending of that war in 53, had an opportunity to reunite just for like 12 hours, but to actually meet, touch, hold, and their family members. And it seems very much that the people of Korea want this, but that certainly the media of the United States very much does not want it. Can you talk a little bit about that big gap between us and the people?
I mean, you know, you stated so many things that attest to the fact that the U.S. relationship with the Koreas, and let's keep in mind that this is a historically triangulated relationship. You know, the signatories of the armistice agreement that brought the hot fighting of the Korean War to a halt but did not end that war were China, North Korea, and the United States. South Korea was not a signatory. And what this means is that the United States has to be involved in any kind of peace process. It is a triangulated relationship that attests to a history of U.S. military imperialism within the larger area. And, you know, like what you were stating about the United States not actually respecting the democratic wishes of the Korean people for peace and reunification really speaks to the very undemocratic nature of the U.S. presence in South Korea. So South Korea is a semi-sovereign state at best. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that South Korea, it actually doesn't even possess command control over its own military forces during times of heightened war conflict. That authority goes to the United States. The other thing, too, is through a series of treaties, you know, these mutual security treaties and the Status of Forces Agreement, which grants U.S. forces extraterritorial rights in these, you know, military basing sites around the world. Basically, I mean, let's just be real about this. The United States would never accept foreign soldiers on its soil practicing war exercises.
No, you know, nor would we allow someone else to have command of our forces.
Exactly. And so, but according to these treaties, the United States, it's not even just that the United States maintains approximately 80 military installations south of the DMZ and stations approximately 30,000 standing forces south of the DMZ, all of this in violation of the terms of the armistice agreement. And it's not just that the United States throughout the Cold War stationed nuclear weapons on South Korea again in violation of the terms of the armistice agreement. It's also that according to these mutual defense treaties and its Status of Forces Agreement, the United States can use at whim and at will any South Korean military facility as though it were its own. And so it's in all of these ways that South Korea has historically had a semi-sovereign relationship with the United States. This goes back, mind you, to 1943 when the Allied powers met in Cairo, and they knew that Japan's defeat was on the horizon. It was clear as day. I mean, this also
and Japan at that time had control of Korea. They had for since 1910, but even before that. So the people of Korea were dominated.
Point. So, you know, the people of Korea had been fighting against Japanese colonial rule. They fully expected that at the time of liberation that they would be free to realize their own forms of democracy. And what happened was in 1943 in Cairo, the Allied leaders decided that in due course, Korea shall be free and independent. Now, even to this day, Korea is not free and independent. It's essentially an militarily occupied country. And indeed, when the United States visited upon the Korean Peninsula, Korea was not a perpetrator during World War II. It was not a militarized superpower the way that Japan was, and it wasn't a fascist superpower the way that one could argue Japan and Germany were. Germany was divided by the United States. So was the victim of Japanese colonialism, Korea. And indeed, by dividing the United States, just a day after the bombing of Nagasaki, Truman deputized two junior military officials to divide the Korean Peninsula. They only had a National Geographic map.
Oh my goodness.
They consulted with no Korean whatsoever, and they simply just drew a line through the map at the 38th parallel. What this in effect did was not only one of the precipitating causes, this along with the fact that the United States rehabilitated the pro-Japanese collaborators on the Korean Peninsula, you know, as a kind of reliably right-wing force throughout the Cold War. But these kinds of factors set the stage for a war of national reunification that we call the Korean War, in which the United States intervened on behalf of its South Korean ally, and South Korea would not exist if the United States hadn't backed it up with military force and insisted on separate elections in the South. But what the United States effectively did by drawing that line through the Koreas was that it divided one in three Korean families. And so some of the images that you were talking about, the heartbreaking images of separated families, look, we're talking about separated families right now in terms of the U.S.-Mexico border. We're talking about families from Mexico, from Central America that have been divided. And even the division for a matter of months or a few years has been something, because this, as we have to acknowledge, extends back to the Barack Obama period too. He wasn't called deporter in chief for no reason.
Exactly.
But despite all of this, the fact is that the kind of human interest in families that were divided and the kind of understanding that this takes a profound toll, a sort of traumatic psychic toll, that's been something that has been part of the conversation around major overhaul, like, you know, the U.S. sort of migration system.
Yes.
Even though we have Trump in office, but think about Koreans. Families have been divided for several decades. And, you know, this is a feature of the unending Korean War for which the United States is largely responsible. Now, the sad truth in this particular historic moment is that Trump, in terms of the post-Cold War period, with exception of Bill Clinton in his late second term when there was some headway made toward the possibility of normalized relations with North Korea, Trump in the post-Cold War period is, you know, he's actually represents, sad to say, the last best hope for U.S. peace with North Korea during a time when separated family members are actually still alive.
Yes. And that's very important because they're aging rapidly, you know, and I saw those photos called heartbreaking, but to me they were they made me happy. The thought that you could actually hold your parent again when you weren't even sure they were alive. And, you know, to me, it was heartwarming to see them holding each other, even with tears running down their faces. I can't imagine what a great moment that was.
Yeah.
And certainly not enough, but it certainly was very real. The emotion was very real on the people's faces. They want to be one nation, one people, yeah, able to be with their families. Christine, we have someone on the phone, I believe. We've got a caller.
Yeah.
And that caller is, again, John. John, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for the great show. And in the century of women, you folks are doing a great job. And I really appreciate the show. I'm 71 years old, and I was in the military in the 60s, and I was in both Vietnam and South Korea. And I'm curious what the professor thinks of the understanding of how when the Korean War was hot in the early 50s, that the way I understand it, MacArthur pulled a Caesar type trip and actually crossed the North Korean Chinese border and encouraged China, then upset China to send, I think, approximately 300,000 troops into North Korea, or at that time just Korea. And also, this is probably an obvious question, but how much do you think the military, as Eisenhower wanted to call it, the military congressional military industrial complex wants to see continued war for, since our number one product in the USA is war material? Trump's a great salesman, of course, for that. Thank you.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John, for the question. Go ahead, Christine.
Yeah, thank you, John. You know, as you mentioned, you know, South Korea was a launching site for U.S. aggression in Vietnam. And so it's no coincidence that you were stationed there in the 1960s. You know, by the time that the Korean War started, you know, it was, there were two Koreas, because the United States had aggressively insisted that South Korea have separate elections and supported a rightist dictator who had absolutely no popular support, Syngman Rhee, in the South. And, you know, MacArthur, he was always someone who sort of believed in that he was the eagle in the Asia-Pacific region, and that his word was law, and he felt totally unrestrained in terms of his pursuit of radical war policy. And with regard to the Korean Peninsula, you know, he actually advocated, he didn't even advocate for it, he requested permission to have commanders discretion to use atomic bombs within the Korean theater. And, you know, as you mentioned, what happened, like, in terms of the perceived start of the Korean War, the United States and South Korea have historically maintained that when North Korea crossed over the 38th parallel into the South, that this was the precipitating act of the Korean War. In point of fact, that area, the 38th parallel, there was crossfire happening all the time. And so this kind of pretext, and let's be honest about the fact that the United States has used pretext in the post-World War II era to engage in multiple conflicts around the world. These pretexts are specious, they're flimsy, and they prove historically not to hold a lot of weight, yet the intervention happens. And so this was a war that the United States, what happened was, you know, the historian Bruce Cummings, who's a historian of the Korean War, he stated, is it possible, since the 38th parallel in the first instance was only supposed to be a demarcation zone that divided the peninsula into occupation zones, can that be understood as an international border, and North Korea's crossing of it, which South Korea had done as well, could that be understood as an act of aggressive war? And so, like, you know, that's the question that he poses. But as you mentioned, what is MacArthur's response to it? It's actually this push with South Korea northward. And, you know, when the United States does it, no problem. When North Korea does it, it's an act of war. And so basically, the United States pushed into the Korean Peninsula and was able to make it up to the North Korea-China border. And what happened at that time was the Chinese had not entered en masse into the Korean War. Why? Because they're fighting their own
This was revolution. Shortly after their revolution in 1949, yeah, and the right, beginning right. of consolidating.
And exactly. And so what happens is, like, actually China is, you know, it used to say that China's relationship with North Korea was as close as lips and teeth, because North Koreans were on the front lines of the Chinese Revolution. And what happened was China pushed back. Now, MacArthur's vision of nuclear annihilation was closely tied to China entering into the war. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to drop 30 to 50 atomic bombs strung across the neck of Manchuria that would create a radioactive cobalt zone where no life could live for 50 to 100 years, thereby making impossible any kind of advance by the Chinese from the north. But even with conventional weapons, what did the United States manage to do? Well, the United States tyrannized from above. It basically, to use Donald Trump's phrase, rained, fire and fury from above. And it was so unrestrained that Pyongyang, which was a city, the capital of North Korea, with only 400,000 residents, the United States dropped 420,000 bombs on Pyongyang alone. That's overkill.
And yeah, that's not just a little bit of overkill. And really, the Korean peninsula was decimated.
So, international observers said there's nothing left to bomb 1 year into the hot fighting. And let's look at the statistics. Historians say that, we know that, maybe almost 30,000 or over 30,000 U.S. forces were killed, some in friendly fire incidents. Let's look at this asymmetrical war. Let's look at it honestly. How many Koreans were killed? 4 to 5 million, the majority of whom, 70% of whom, were civilians. 4 to 5 million.
I know, it's hard to even get our mind around. And, the war is far enough behind us, even before Vietnam, that probably the overwhelming majority of people under 30 know very, very little about the war at all. They weren't raised in the post-war era, and so didn't post-World War II era, and so didn't hear much about it. MacArthur, I believe, got fired, basically. He got yanked from his job there, but only after he had created that kind of difficulty. And I want to mention also that at least in the northern part of Korea, under the Japanese, they were forced to speak Japanese. Their language was taken away from them for over 40 years, and in school and in all public things, they were to speak Japanese, which is, it's clearly culture destroying. That's the point, is to destroy a culture when you take away their language, as we've seen in other instances, as the U.S. did with Native Americans. I do want to let people know they can call again, Christine. Just 1 second. It's 503-231-8187. We want to hear your questions and concerns about the ongoing tensions between the United States and Korea. Go ahead, Christine.
Linda, what you mentioned is the entirety of Korea was under Japanese colonial rule. There were scholars who actually examined the per capita intake of rice. Rice is the staple of the Korean diet. And during the Japanese colonial period, the per capita consumption of rice was halved. And, Koreans were exported as slave labor, not just military sexual labor with the notorious comfort women system, but as slave labor throughout Japanese empire.
Yeah, I saw a number saying over 800,000 Korean men were put into the Korean men were put into the Japanese military as well as laborers.
Right. This is the other thing, too. As you were mentioning, it's when you're talking about spirit or culture destroying, that is the framer of the idea of genocide. Raphael Lemkin understood that it's not just barbarism that informs genocide, the destruction of the people, but also vandalism, the destruction of the culture. And with regard to Japan's colonization of the Korean Peninsula, it was a form of settler colonialism. We usually talk about settler colonialism with regard to white imperial powers that, landed in, various quote-unquote new worlds, whether it be Australia or North America. Japan, its form of colonial rule in Korea was a form of colonial rule that was meant to destroy and to replace and to utterly replace Korean culture with Japanese.
And just to let our audience know, the Korean culture is so old. I was looking back at it, and, in 700 AD or something, they invented the first movable printing press, and poetry that goes back far longer than that, a very advanced and refined culture in many ways that none of us ever know that. And we seem to not realize that about, here in America, we seem to not realize, one, that it's true that these other nations have cultures, you know, 10 times as long as ours, but also that those cultures were full civilization, refined, you know, meeting all those kinds of all those kinds of criteria when we say civilization. I do believe we have a caller on the line. It's Tony. Hi, Tony. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate what you're talking about. Now, I've been trying to read about all this, and I can never get to the bottom of things at all. But, and my question may be naive, but what does the United States want out of that part of the world? Is it a strategic location? Is it resources or cheap labor force? I just don't understand all that. So I'll take your comments.
Thanks a lot for that question, Tony. Go ahead, Christine.
Thank you, Tony. You know, I mean, you could say that there has been tremendous continuity between the U.S. Cold War and post-Cold War foreign policy. And if you indeed even look at, you know, the U.S. National Defense Strategy and other Pentagon documents, even from this year, you can see that the logic hasn't changed. Those documents actually describe Russia and China as the major threats to the United States. And, you know, that is very similar to U.S. Cold War logic. And so let's look at U.S. hot fighting in, you know, the Cold War turned instantly hot, or almost instantly hot in the Asia-Pacific region in terms of first Korea and then Japan. And I think it's no coincidence that it's not just people who are under 30, but it's just any American. Like, people don't know what the Korean War was about because, unlike Vietnam, it wasn't a collective consciousness-raising event for an entire generation. In fact, it was known immediately. It was referred to in U.S. News and World Report as the Forgotten War in 1951.
And so, I bet most Americans' closest knowledge of it is that TV program MASH that was Army military.
An allegory for Vietnam.
Yeah, and it was an allegory at that time, yeah. But that's probably the most that we've heard. You know, that's the most we see it. Oh yeah, Alan Alda, you know, doing dirty jokes and medicine in some war zone.
Right, right. In the Santa Monica Mountains / Korea or whatever, you know.
And, yeah. It did look like the Santa Monica Mountains, didn't it?
It really does. I'm like, that doesn't look like Korea at all, you know, but never mind the details, you know. But, you know, it's, so I would say that, you know, if you look actually most recently, so, you know, what's interesting about Trump is that he has adopted a kind of all but Obama policy in many different areas. And with regard to Korea, he has stated that his is not a strategic patience policy, which was the defining policy of Barack Obama. So what was the strategic patience policy? And we have to ask, is Trump's maximum pressure policy really any different from Obama's policy? The answer is no. In fact, what both Obama and Hillary Clinton, who was his first Secretary of State, what they crafted and what they viewed to be their signature foreign policy was not endless intervention, you know, for example, in Libya, or continued intervention in, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq. It was actually, they viewed the Asia-Pacific area as the site of America's economic future. In fact, Hillary Clinton said as much in a policy document that she wrote for the journal Foreign Policy. She said that that this century is America's Pacific century. And she stated that against all of those Americans who are tired of war after a decade of war in the Middle East and want the, you know, to call back all of our armed forces stationed all around the world, that with regard to Asia and the Pacific, the United States had to resist those calls because that militarized infrastructure formed the basis of this pivot policy to the Asia-Pacific region, in which the United States was going to concentrate 60% of its naval resources away from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And, you know, the argument that was used very speciously by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, every single fortified war exercise. Every single trilateral war exercise, multilateral war exercise, bilateral war exercise that the United States conducted with various allies in the Asia-Pacific region, every single weapon sales, because Obama, too, was a hawker of U.S. weapons, every single missile deployment or missile defense system that was deployed to the region was justified in the name of a nuclear-armed, dangerous, irrational North Korea. So Obama never took any measures to actually engage with North Korea and instead achieved strategically what? Well, he actually, by using the North Korea boogeyman, managed in the post-Cold War period to encircle the biggest U.S. economic competitor in the region, that is to say, China. And so basically an anti-NK North Korea policy on the part of the United States has always served the purpose, both during the Cold War as well as in the post-Cold War period, of being an anti-China policy.
And I believe that Trump in his tweets is a little bit more straightforward about that, saying, though I don't know if he's saying, if this is true, but what he's saying in his tweets is, hey, you know, China's not doing what we want. China started sending more goods across the border to Korea. So, you know, until we get better talks with China, we're not going to see any movement with North Korea. And so it seems like he's saying that, you know, that he's just straight out saying, you know, we're using peace with North Korea as leverage against China. We do have another caller on the line, though, I believe. It's George. So let's let George in here. Good morning, George.
Good morning. I am classified as a Korean veteran. I didn't set foot in Korea, but I was active duty Army during the conflict, or the what's called the police action. And I know you touched on this, your guest touched on this earlier, but I'm still a little bit confused about how North Korea was first established. And what I've been telling my students, I teach various classes, is that after the end of the war in Europe, when after the Germans, Nazis surrendered, we were very anxious to get Russia to help us possibly invade Japan. And they did enter the Second World War in the Pacific. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, they continued to fight the Japanese for 2 weeks after the unconditional surrender. So they said, okay, we helped you with your battle against Japan, and now the two atomic bombs have gone off. It's changed the the chemistry of the whole situation enormously. So now Japan has surrendered. Russia says, what are our spoils of war? And we would like some of these northern Japanese islands. And we said, no, 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 that's not okay. We're going to give you you're going to have influence with North Korea. Now, that's what I've been telling people, and that is my conviction. But please correct me if I'm wrong.
Christine, talk about that. Certainly Russia played a role post-World War II or right in the end of it.
Sure. You know, I'm happy to talk about that. I also wanted to take up the comment that this was speciously, you know, these sort of informal wars that the United States has waged in the wake of World War II, you know, get called various names, euphemisms, and one of them was the police action. But in point of fact, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this is not a time of sort of political galvanization on the part of American protesters against the war, but there were people who protested the so-called U.S. police action, and one of them was actually Paul Robeson. And Paul Robeson,
the famous singer, the famous African-American singer.
Right, and black radical. And, you know, he was part of an organization called Civil Rights Congress. And Civil Rights Congress in 1951 delivered a petition to the United Nations that stated that the United States was committing genocide by permitting a lynching policy, a Jim Crow lynching policy against, blacks within the United States. And it also mentioned in that document that because the bomber could go unrebuked in Korea, so too could the lyncher go unrebuked at home. And it also stated something else about this so-called sort of time of a U.S. police action abroad. It stated that the mode of lynching within the United States had shifted. It had shifted from the noose, the lyncher's noose, to the policeman's bullet. And so these black radicals thought...
How did the noose get established in the first place?
Yeah, so I'll say that.
Back in August of 45.
Yeah, she's getting there.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm getting there. So basically, these two things they saw as linked. One was a police action abroad and a rising police state at home. And so I think that that's really a very interesting moment in which there was a black radical critique of that persisted in viewing U.S. warfare as a mode of fascism. And so you talked about the end of World War II. With regard to, and the United States emerged out of that totally triumphant. And, you know, it makes us forget the fact that blacks during World War II, even like mainstream black newspapers like the Pittsburgh Courier, described black involvement in U.S. warfare during World War II as a two-front struggle, a struggle against racist fascism over there and racist fascism at home. In the wake of World War II and U.S. victory, that discourse of U.S. fascism largely disappeared, and it really made it so that it was impossible for us to have critical analysis of these interventions that followed. Now, with regard to North Korea and Russia, let's look at someone like Anna Louise Strong. She wrote from within North Korea during the time of its socialist revolution. She saw what was happening on the ground. She saw it absolutely transforming. And in contrast to the South, which was a police state, it wasn't just a, you know, they weren't just setting the ground for a police action. U.S. forces in South Korea basically had such tight control, it was a political police state, and nothing could really emerge critical out of South Korea. She described the Russian occupation of the North as very, very loose, you know, as one that actually respected a process that had happened throughout the entire Korean Peninsula. Throughout the Korean Peninsula, in the wake of Korea's liberation from Japan in 1945, Koreans all over formed these local people's councils, these PCs. They formed them all over, and they reflected the local character of the regions in which they were established. Now, these PCs were absolutely fundamental to the foundation of North Korean socialism. And, you know, but with regard to the Southern and the Soviet forces respected them. By contrast, in the South, these were red-baited. They were, even in 1948, what happened was the People's Council in Jeju, which is about as far as you can get from North Korea in terms of the Korean Peninsula. It's an island to the south of the southernmost tip of the Korean Peninsula. People there rebelled through the People's Committee Chu, conveying their displeasure with the U.S.-backed separate elections in the South. And what happened was U.S.-backed South Korean forces committed a war, and this is 48 prior to the so-called start of the war in 1950. Basically, what happened was South Korean forces with U.S. backing and command with U.S. armament decimated the population of Jeju. And, you know, one question I always have is why isn't that understood as part of the Korean War? But, you know, I may just have to say this to you, which is that your sense that there were sort of two occupations is correct. But in point of fact, if you look at the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that's not just the ending or concluding act of World War II. It's the precipitating act of the Cold War. The United States is sending a message to the Soviet Union. It's saying, this Pacific theater, hands off, it's ours. We will settle it as we choose to. So basically, the Soviet Union was on notice, and the two occupations were fundamentally different in character.
When did that flare up to be what we began to call the police action?
I mean, you know, basically with, you know,
with the bombing of that island and then following that. And
oh, it wasn't just, it was a wholesale massacre. That was 1948. That was April 3rd of 1948. It was a terror regime. In fact, historians of that wholesale slaughter describe it as a strategy akin to U.S. Indian policy within the United States and Indian wars, because it was scorched earth and nature.
Yes.
But in terms of formal U.S. Intervention, you know, the occupation period follows the wake of World War II, but formal U.S. intervention militarily into the so-called police action starts June 25th, 1950. But,
so
you know, I wanted to go back to another point that you had raised, Linda, which is that the Korean people, their democratic desire is for peace and reunification. Let's recall that Moon Jae-in, who is the president of South Korea, he was elected in a snap election. What had happened in 2016 was that the South Korean people took to the streets to the tune of millions. Millions of people took to the streets. This wasn't well covered in the United States.
Yes, I know.
And they were demanding the ouster of his right-wing predecessor, who had a very, very symbiotic relationship with Barack Obama in terms of an anti-North Korea policy. And so what happened was they ousted her for corruption, for her neoliberal policies. They ousted her for her hardline position with regard to North Korea and for her concessions, her sovereignty concessions to the United States. And, you know, what Moon Jae-in understood was that he was deputized when he was elected by these people in these who took to the streets in this candlelight revolution. Basically, he understood that he was deputized to push for peace with North Korea. That's the democratic desire of the South Korean people.
I think all the polls have shown, I just want to throw this in here, Christine, the polls that have been done show that it's well over 80%. The United States would like to have those polls come out differently. And I do want to give that phone number out again to make sure we have still have time for callers, 503-231-8187. But I'm glad you're taking it back to what the people of Korea want, because as it led up to the Olympics this winter, and certainly their selection, their actual democratic selection of Moon Jae-in played a huge role in this. It became clearer and clearer that people wanted to do a united Olympics. And the United States did all sorts of things, sending Pence there and having him leave rooms when he was unhappy with things and come back. But Kim Jong-un's sister, I believe, came and attended. She was an official representative from North Korea. And they had a group of cheerleaders, which the United States and you like to make fun of, but that the Korean people definitely appeared to love and joined in with. Yeah. And to me, when they marched in together, it was just evident. And it actually sort of caught hold with some of the U.S. News personnel who were covering the Olympics, or sports personnel, whatever you want to call them, because you could see them not being able to keep a frown on it, or not being able to, you know, like one time one finally threw in, but let's not forget, North Korea, you know, is one of the most brutal regimes ever in history. And then went back to, but the people are all happy and clapping. And it was so amazing. And over 80% wanting reunification, despite what it looks like is that the U.S.'s establishment, the military industrial intelligence community, very much does not want it. And their control of the press here is amazing in terms of how much bad press there is. And it's flooding again today. Every opportunity there is to try to convince the American people that we should never be able to unite with North Korea. They can't be trusted and they're horrible. So, Christine, can you talk a little bit about this contrast between the people of Korea and then the way that the U.S. press is handling this? I believe, though.
I'd be glad to. Yeah.
Okay. I'll give you a chance, but I believe I got another caller on the line. Sorry, I asked you before. It's John. John.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Do you think one of the reasons I mean, the modern reasons, we're not talking about the 50s, the Cold War, or whatever, is that if there was a unification of Korea, the potential of industrial ingenuity and output would kind of tip the balance between, like, Japan and China, which are big, you know, manufacturing powerhouses. Like, after World War II, Japan came back, and now we have Toyotas, we have Mitsubishis. Now, look at China. Almost all of our industrial manufacturing has been transferred over to China because of cheap labor and lots of labor. And look at the small, not the small, but the big, what do you call it, strides that Korea's made with Samsung and Hyundai's and KIA's. So if you put that with South and North, you know, unifying, you're going to have a really, you know, competitive industrial base that will tip the balance of not just Japan and China, but it will further erode the United States manufacturing, you know, base.
That's a really good question. Christine, can you address that along with the rest of what we were talking about?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, it's when you speak about Japan recovering in the post-war period, it's really important that we recognize that the way that Japan became an economic powerhouse was by furnishing war material to the United States in both the Korean theater and the Vietnam theater. So it was part and parcel of, you know, basically the U.S. war machine, even though it has a peace clause in its own constitution. And, you know, with regard to the Korea's post-reunification, I think that this is something that it's important to also recognize that South Korean labor has issued a series of statements that on the one hand applaud the kinds of strides that Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un made toward a much warmer dialogue between the two Koreas. And they've also applauded Donald Trump making forays with North Korea, but they also have a cautionary tone. And what they state is that the vision of reunification and prosperity and peace to come cannot exclude workers, and that workers in South Korea and workers in North Korea have to be absolutely foundational to the articulation of what that peace and prosperity means. And, you know, what you mentioned.
So the industrial base may be a unionized industrial base.
Well, I mean, I think that Samsung, you know, there's been places like Kaesong, which are, you know, in the middle of the Koreas, which has served as a kind of site of cheap labor for South Korea when it was active. And I do think that South Korean chaebol, or these major corporations, these family-owned corporations like Samsung and, you know, Hyundai and corporations like that, I do think that they look at the North as a cheap labor pool. Now, North Korea, from the period of Kim Il-sung to the present day, has always maintained that it cannot simply be neoliberally absorbed into the South the way that East Germany was absorbed by West Germany. And but I do think that for many people who are pro-reunification, it's not just a progressive discourse. It has a very strong neoliberal component. The other thing that I would ask is, what was Trump's investment in peace? Well, on the one hand, he seems to have this really interesting view, and I'm fine with it, actually, where he thinks that U.S. military occupation of other countries amounts to a kind of form of welfare, and that, you know, these countries should pay for it, or the U.S. military should withdraw its forces. Well, you know, I say withdraw your forces.
Yeah, really?
You know, and,
yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, but I want to just say that, like, actually, what's interesting is that Pompeo's vision of, you know, like, one thing that both Russia and China have stated is that now that North Korea has made all these major good faith strides to demonstrate to the United States that it's serious about the business of peace and engagement with the United States, but Russia and China have stated is that the United States needs to scale back its sanctions. But Donald Trump has maintained this maximum pressure policy. And in fact, when Pompeo has been asked about, like, you know, can you sort of relieve some of these sanctions, which would be a very, you know, let's keep in mind these sanctions are meant to destroy North Korea. They're incommensurate with any kind of engagement talk. But Pompeo stated that even if he were to, you know, sort of scale back the sanctions, the State Department would not offer humanitarian aid the way the State Department has in the past. In fact, let's be mindful of the fact that George W. Bush, who called North Korea as part of the axis of evil, in his late second term, that's usually when U.S. presidents belatedly get vision on North Korea, he actually gave more food aid to North Korea than Barack Obama did during the entirety of his presidency, and he maintained an absolutely lamentable hardline policy toward North Korea.
You know, we're just out of time. We're running right out. If you can make your last statement, we'll have to leave on that. Christine Hong, professor at UC Santa Cruz.
Okay. Can I make my last point?
Yeah.
Oh, it's basically, this is the most important point. It's that it's the Korean people's democratic desire for peace and reunification. And right now, in this weird moment in which Donald Trump has, at least to some degree, no matter what his sort of waffling, entertained the prospect of peace, actually the Democrats in Congress, they've stood up and saluted not the flag or pledged allegiance to the flag. They've actually pledged allegiance to the military-industrial complex, and they've actually introduced legislation and passed legislation that would make it impossible for Trump to scale back U.S. forces without congressional approval. And so this is what I have to say to the Democratic and Republican bipartisan war party. Get out of the way of the Korean,
Korean democratic people's
desires for peace.
Thank you so much, Christine Hong. That's the message to the U.S. military-industrial complex. Get out of North Korea. Get out of Korea entirely and allow the people to reunify. This has been Linda Olsen-Osterlund on More Talk Radio. And onward now to the rest of your KBOO morning news and public affairs.
Tune in on August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Emma Lugo of Transpositive will host this special on-air program. You can join us that night at the Queer Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 31st. More information about the Queer Community Open House and anniversary programming is available at kboo.fm.